This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. A warming planet, rising seas, and more extreme weather cycles. These are some of the hallmarks of climate change, and while some critics of the idea tie it all to politics, Floridians, especially South Florida residents, are getting a glimpse into what a warmer planet may look like. Philippe Cousteau is a filmmaker and explorer, the grandson of the ocean explorer Jacques Cousteau. We caught up with Cousteau at the Sustainability Symposium in Orlando. He began by talking about his grandfather.
You know, growing up with him, he was such a big influence in my life. But one of my favorite memories was I was 10 years old, I believe it was, and the Game Boy, the handheld, original handheld Nintendo gaming device had just come out. And this was like the thing for every kid out there. And I was living in the States at the time. My mother's American. My father died 6 months before I was born. So I grew up mostly here in the U.S. So we were living in Connecticut, and whenever my grandfather went to New York, we'd visit him. So we were having dinner. It was right around the holidays. And I remember my grandfather turning to me and asking me about Game Boy. And I was amazed because he would have been, 79, I believe, at the time. And the fact that my 79-year-old grandfather knew all about Game Boy for a 9 or 10-year-old boy was pretty amazing. And he had one and loved it and played it. And I just remember the lesson that I took away from that, because as we spoke about it, we didn't just talk about the games, but he talked to me about, you know, Philippe, this kind of technology isn't just for entertainment, but we must always look at this new technology as a way to educate and inspire people. And that was an important lesson for me coming away, to always be looking at the next step, the next innovation in storytelling, and recognizing that we have to leverage that. He was a pioneer. You know, television was relatively new when his shows came out. There were only 3 channels on television. But he was always pushing the envelope, and that was an important lesson that I learned from him. And also a lot of fun that we had spending, you know, an hour talking about Tetris and Super Mario Brothers. So it was a fun memory.
What do you think he would make of the explosion in social media we have now, and that the access people would have to pretty much any kind of media under the sun, all on your smartphone?
Yeah, I think he'd see it as a tremendous opportunity. He was such an optimist. As I see it as a tremendous opportunity, being able to provide information to people and being able to, particularly what excites me, is being able to make them part of the adventure in a way that you couldn't when it was just kind of sit down and watch television. It was a one-way conversation. Now it can be a two-way conversation. And particularly with new technologies like virtual reality, you can transport people to these places, make them a part of that journey in a way that we could never do before. And I think that kind of buy-in and that engagement will only lead to good things for people understanding and caring about the world.
Do you have plans, Philippe Cousteau, to bring what you're doing, trying to promote the idea of the oceans and conservation, to the virtual reality world? Like, do you have plans to make that a reality?
Yeah, absolutely. We're working on a new project right now with a major VR company right in LA, actually. And really, how do we leverage that technology to create, and this is the key with VR, a narrative story using virtual reality, not just a 360-degree camera, which are a lot of fun as well. But how do we create a narrative story with VR? And so we're going to be doing that this year and launching those in the next year or so.
I want to ask, too, about a series of web videos you've made on the website, Great Big Story. They seem like they're inspired by the Wes Anderson movie, The Life Aquatic. Tell me about what you're trying to do with these videos.
Well, Great Big Story is an online digital media site that's dedicated to stories about the weird and the wonderful in this world. And when they contacted me, their division, they're owned by CNN, and when they contacted me, they asked me about working on a project with them, and I said, I would love to do that as long as that project can be something completely different than anything I've done before. And being a fan of The Life Aquatic, Wes Anderson, Bill Murray, etc., we kind of settled on paying a bit of an homage to that style of filmmaking, and what I would argue, creating a new genre. It's what I call scripted unscripted. And the whole concept was we could create a scripted kind of acted series, but that deals with real science and real information. We interview real scientists on the show, but we do it in a fun and quirky way. And the whole idea is to create a different approach to telling these stories. You know, there's a sector of society that will watch documentaries. There's a sector of society that will read articles. There's also a sector of society that won't. So how do we reach people through entertainment with real stories, real information, that they sit down and watch not because they feel like they have to or they're already predisposed to caring about these issues, but because it's funny and it's fun and they want to share it with their friends because it's entertaining. And that's what The Aquatic World of Philippe Cousteau is designed to do, and it's been a tremendous success, and we're already looking at third season. We've had two seasons out now, and they're short. They're only 2 to 3 minutes each, so it's easily digestible for this, you know, modern audience, and it's one of the most exciting projects I've been working on of the last year.
Is it a gateway to documentaries, or is it an end in itself, having people watch these little snippets of scientific exploration?
I hope that it piques people's interest. You know, one of the primary comments we get from folks is like, is this real? Like, wow, I had no idea about that narwhals have nerve receptors in their horns. I had no idea about isopods and pistol shrimp and goby fish. I had no idea about conch shell for the Sargasso Sea. And so I do hope that it's a bit of a gateway for people being inquisitive about the world around them, and that's certainly the goal. But even if they just watch those and learn a little something there and recognize that exploring the world can be fun, that's a win.
Your story about your granddad and the Game Boy, mm-hmm. It sounds like he was pretty plugged into the media of the day. What do you think he would have made of the movie The Life Aquatic? Would he have appreciated the humor in that?
I think he would have. He had a great sense of humor. You know, people remember him as this, you know, iconic leader and thinker and filmmaker and storyteller and writer. But I remember somebody who loved to play with model train sets and who loved a glass of wine and to tell a good story and, you know, had endless stories, of course, to share. I think he would have really appreciated, again, a different approach to telling these stories and getting people engaged in these issues.
You mentioned conch shell just now, and there's something fairly similar to that, an undersea laboratory that NASA has off the Keys. Tell me about the link between those two. I guess conch shell was the precursor to what NASA has going on with Aquarius.
Well, conch shell was the first time that people had ever lived for an extended period underwater. There were three of them, actually, conch shell 1, 2, and 3. The first one was at a relatively shallow depth for a week off the coast of Marseille. The second one was in the Red Sea at about 60 feet for 30 days or so, and a deeper one at about 80 feet, 90 feet, somewhere in there. And then the third one, I believe, was around 300 feet, again, in the Mediterranean. But that was pioneering work. No one had ever lived for any extended period underwater back in the 1960s. So conch shell was really started it all. Then the U.S. Navy had Sea Lab that my father was also involved in. And it was an attempt to even see if it was possible for people to live underwater. We didn't understand the physiological impacts of that, of which there are some. And Aquarius is, you know, the continuation. And unfortunately, it's the only thing like it in the world. I think it shows that our investment in ocean exploration pales compared to our investment in space. And while I'm not against space exploration, you know, we have a space, you know, laboratories in space. We have shuttle rockets going into space. And we still don't understand enough about the ocean. And the fact that we have one underwater research laboratory on this planet in Aquarius off Key Largo, I think is shocking. They do terrific work there, but it's an example of our underinvestment in exploring the world here that keeps us alive every day.
Philippe Cousteau, the oceans that you have explored and are exploring now, I guess, are different from what your father, what your grandfather would have been exploring. I mean, there's climate change, the temperature of the water is going up, different species in places they shouldn't be. When you look at the ocean now and think back to the last 30, 40 years, are you optimistic about the future of the oceans?
I am always optimistic. You have to be optimistic. Unfortunately, the last, I would say, 60 years post, you know, 60, 70 years post World War II have seen the greatest destruction, not just of the oceans, but of our planet as a whole. And we have lost a tremendous amount. You know, and the trends in some cases continue to be worrisome, but in others are hopeful. You know, in many places, fisheries are recovering in Europe and the United States. We're enacting really smart legislation to do a better job of building sustainability around our seafood sources. We're expanding the amount of marine protected areas, which is a vital tool in our arsenal, and recognizing the importance of setting parts of the ocean aside President Obama was a true visionary when he established the North Atlantic Seamounts Marine Monument just in the last few months, the first of its kind off the Atlantic coast of the United States, and we need more of them. So there is a lot of good things happening, but certainly that is tempered by ocean acidification, by the decline of things like the Great Barrier Reef and the coral bleaching incident that we just had that wiped out more than 50% of that incredible place. So there's a lot more work to be done, but we are making progress. And I think, and I always believe in the incredible ability for humans to overcome challenges.
Philippe Cousteau, thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And for an idea of the impact of sea level rise, look no further than South Florida. We talked to Philip K. Stoddart. He's the mayor of South Miami and a biology professor at Florida International University.
Mayor Stoddart, talk to me about what you're seeing in South Florida as far as the immediate impacts of the changing climate, for example, king tides, rising sea levels.
One of the things that people have not quite connected with is that what happens underground is ultimately followed by what happens above ground. So below ground, changes are beginning to happen. The water tables are coming up, and they're beginning to compromise the sewage systems. They're compromising the septic systems, and they're creating pollution problems that people didn't even know existed. So when the king tide started appearing in Miami Beach this past year, we were horrified to discover that it was mixed with sewage. Nobody knew that there was this underground sea level rise problem until it reaches the surface. So what I'm trying to do now is to anticipate these problems, talking with geotechnical people to understand what's happening underground. There's threats to our water supply. The Biscayne Aquifer, upon which we depend for our drinking water, is compromised by saltwater intrusion. We're going to lose our fresh water supply. The septic systems will fail when the water table reaches the drain fields. The toilets flush into the bathtub. No mayor wants to see that happen in their city, so we've got to head that one off. We know that the sewer systems are prone to infiltration. So the first infrastructure challenges, curiously enough, are happening below our feet where we can't even see them.
Do you still want to be mayor of South Miami with all of this stuff going on? It sounds like it could be quite catastrophic.
Well, I think a smart mayor tries to head off some of these problems in advance. I mean, if you act now, you can prevent the catastrophes, or you can slow them down, or you can delay them and give people time to understand what's going on and make the necessary changes. And that's my role, is to, you know, look into the crystal ball, project forward, see what's coming, and now make changes today to try to head some of that off or delay it.
Just remind our listeners, what is the size of the city? How many people do you have?
We're relatively small. We have 14,000. We're an old city. We're noisy. We like to think forwards. And because we're small and well-connected with a great downtown, we interface with a lot of other municipalities, and we start movements and we start brush fires in South Miami that then spread to other areas. So, and we also steal from the best. One of the things that is great about municipal government is that you're small and nimble enough to try new things and to share with other mayors. So all of the really interesting stuff that's happening in governance in the United States today is starting at the municipal levels. We're at a conference on sustainability here in Orlando, and I have every intention of stealing good ideas from some of the other mayors who've come to this conference.
But the flip side of that, I guess, being a small city with only 14,000 people, is if you're looking at a problem like a failing sewage system, for example, for a city, or a rising water table, these are some pretty complex engineering challenges, and they're expensive. So how do you pay for the fixes?
We are struggling with that right now. And we had money in our budget to begin working on this, and Governor Scott vetoed it 2 years in a row. The legislature actually afforded us the money. And so we're very hopeful that this year Governor Scott will not do so if the legislature is so good as to give us a third try.
How are people in your city reacting to this threat of rising seas?
He said, oh my God, you're right. We thought you were making this stuff up. In South Miami, we have not yet had the coastal waters coming in. We're about a mile in from the coast. The salt water has come up to the edge of our city underground. Very few people know this. They're going to start seeing some issues with trees at some point. But in the coastal areas around, people are saying, you know, gee, you weren't making this stuff up. I've been talking about this for 20 years, since long before I was in elected office. As a biology professor, you know, you can figure out what's coming because you're reading the science literature every day.
So are people now willing to try and effect some change, or is that still an uphill battle?
People are very interested in effecting change, and they look to their leaders, you know, for direction. So you look at, first of all, you look at the president. What's the president saying and doing? Well, we've had a pretty good president of late with respect to these particular issues. I think Obama came to the table on these things in his second term. We didn't see much action in the first as he was focusing on other issues. But then you come down a level to the Congress, and we're not seeing action at the level of the Congress. I mean, here in South Florida, finally our two local congressmen are saying that there's an issue, but they're not proposing any action or solutions to it so far. So I'm really looking to give them a sharp poke and get them moving and actually doing something rather than just talking about the fact that there's a need for more study or some such thing. You come down to the state level. We have a governor who has been a climate denier. You come down to the legislature. Oh, my God, you know, the legislature is not interested in helping out. And so then it comes down to the county level. And so we've got a four-county compact, pretty good compact on these issues. But again, Miami-Dade County has been the one that has lagged the other three counties in that compact. So we're slow to the table there. And then it comes down to the municipal level. Here I am. And what I've found is that the most effective thing I can do is to bring the issues to the national attention. And my residents are on board. But we need to affect change all up and down the ladder. And you do that sometimes by explaining things clearly and making a lot of noise about it.
What do you need from the federal government when you look ahead to the next administration? What are your thoughts there and what are you hoping for?
Well, two things. We need a massive collaboration on renewable energy at the federal level. Certainly the private sector is going to do it anyway, but it always helps to have cooperation with the feds. Things just happen that much faster. And the other thing is to start planning for coastal transition. The coastal regions from Key West up to Maine and down the other side of the state, certainly happening in Alaska already, Hawaii is seeing it as well. In all the coastal areas, we're going to be giving land back to the ocean for the first time in our history. A lot of land. And there's no plan for it. There's no laws to facilitate how it happens. Everybody assumes that the feds are going to bail them out and make them whole. And we know there isn't that much money in the federal budget. And so the federal government needs to start talking about this and letting the people of America know what it can and will do for them and what it can and will not do for them and what people have to do for themselves and what local governments have to do for themselves. And that conversation has never happened at the federal level.
Philip K. Stoddart is Mayor of South Miami. Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure.
Still to come, step inside the world of the Maitland Art and History Centre, where the legacy of architect and artist J. Andre Smith is kept alive, and Brianna Daniel works toward her vision of a mobile shower unit for the homeless. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Back in 1937, J. Andre Smith founded an artist colony in Maitland. The colony is still there today, a fantastic architectural oasis just steps away from the rumbling traffic of 1792. Giant oak trees draped with Spanish moss loom over the Mayan-themed courtyard. There's a nook where Smith took tea with Central Florida literary luminary Zora Neale Hurston. And it's where we meet writer-in-residence Danny Powell. Powell is working on a series of short stories inspired by photographs he picks up in antique stores. His project's called Found Memories.
Andre Smith was a sculptor who founded the research studio in 1937, which has now become the Maitland Art Center. So people in the community, if they've heard of A&H Maitland or if they've heard of the Maitland Art Center, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the research studio, which was really founded as an artist colony. Andre Smith wanted to bring in artists from all over, I believe, to live and work here as, you know, an inspiring, creative place for people to do their work, to do what they do. And so that tradition continues now with two main residency programs for artists and writers.
So for a writer in residence engaging with the audience, what's that like? Do you do live readings? Do you have people give you feedback on your stuff in real time? How does it work?
When people come to my studio, they can certainly see what I'm up to in one particular way, and that is I like to spread my stories around the room. I hang them on the wall, just like, you know, some of the visual artists might do in their studios. And so people can actually see the work on the page. When it comes to sort of more abstract things, like what am I currently working on, or sort of, you know, what's actually on the laptop at that moment, that's sort of a strange thing because, again, we're not used to doing this, and it's not sort of typically what happens. And many writers might find that very intimidating or even not very helpful to the work. But for me, it's not so much about, you know, talking about it in a way that someone can understand something that they can't actually see or read right on the spot. It's more so talking about what's interesting me at that particular moment, what might be haunting me in terms of the questions I want to ask or the things I want to explore in the work, which again is not always something writers want to do for various reasons. The project I'm currently working on here at A&H Maitland makes it a lot easier to do that because it incorporates photographs, and so people can see those, they can look at the images, and that's sort of a way in for them. And then we can then take the conversation in a much larger direction by talking about, well, then how am I using those to tell stories, or how am I using those to create narratives?
So tell me a little more about your source of inspiration here. You go and find old photographs, old images, or is it sometimes physical objects, and use that to build a story around?
It's mainly photographs. I've thought about using objects. I'm really into that idea. I haven't really done that yet. I've wanted to teach workshops, creative writing workshops, around that idea, because I think for some people that may be easier than photographs, because photographs are saying so much a lot of times, and so they may be saying too, you know, so much to someone that they find it hard to find, you know, one narrative to focus on. But for me, I've always loved still images and moving images.
So you've got some examples.
So this is the album that I put together over the course of this project, and it kind of gives a look at what images are sort of saying to me, but also I don't look for any particular one type of image. I don't necessarily have, I definitely don't come into my searching for photographs with any intentions or with any sort of agenda. I really do just look for ones that jump out at me in terms of just, you know, the expression on someone's face or an interesting composition.
You'd sometimes combine a couple and make a story out of maybe more than one picture?
So far, it's all been a single image, but as I continue to explore and find photographs and work on this project, I'm starting to see patterns. I'm starting to see recurring elements and recurring themes. I'll even find, you know, on different dates, I'll find photographs that may have come from the same person or family, or may be the same location, or I'll see a face that I recognize from something that I've already collected.
So you're spending quite a bit of time antiquing, and you're learning a little more about how some of these photographs end up in these shops.
Well, surprisingly, I don't spend a lot of time doing this. I honestly have probably gone actively looking for photographs 5 or 6 times over the course of a couple of years.
And I guess there's a chance, too, that somebody might come along to one of your readings and say, hey, I recognize that person. That's like a relative of some sort, or they might know the person in the photograph.
I've definitely made up, I guess, scenarios in my mind where that happens and how I might deal with that. Hopefully it's, you know, it's a very positive experience where people, you know, enjoy the work and, you know, like the fact that the photographs have taken on a sort of new life in a way. But I wonder, though, if there could be some sort of friction involved with that, because to go back to what you said a minute ago, you know, in this process, I haven't learned a lot about the photographs. Most of the time, there's very little information written on them. Sometimes there's something on the back, but sometimes it's illegible. Sometimes it's a location I've never heard of. Sometimes it's just people's names. It's very rare that there's something that really tells you exactly who this person is, at least by name and the location, and again, anything else that's identifying where you could actually say, I know what this photograph is really about, or I know enough of it, you know, enough about this photograph to have some sort of sense of where it came from. My guess is that, you know, most of these photographs end up in these places because of like estate sales, or people are letting go of these images, and that's really kind of a, as interesting as that might sound, it's also kind of sad to me. And that's another layer of experience that you grapple with as you go through these photographs.
Let's take this one, for example. You got, it looks like it's almost been taken from a moving car. What does this photograph say to you, the Sunset Cafe one?
Okay, so this is one where I have written the story, and the story is about two women who meet in this cafe weekly, basically for conversations about, you know, what's going on in their lives. I was really taken by some of the repetition in this photograph, and also the blurriness. I don't come across a lot of photos that are blurry.
This photograph also has the date on it, which is September 67.
September 67, and for me, going back to one thing I mentioned earlier, I didn't at one point want to know too much about each photograph. I didn't necessarily want to know when, where, who. I would ignore a lot of the information that I would find on the photograph. But now, as the project has developed, I actually love to know dates, because I can then put them into sort of a historical context, and history is finding its way into the stories more and more.
You've spent some time kind of assembling these photographs, and you tend to kind of arrange them thematically. Is there one theme that you find yourself coming back to time and again as a writer, or certain photographs that really inspire you?
Well, I think because the photographs sort of capture moments in people's lives and certain memories, thematically, questions about memory, questions about the past, and certainly loss in many ways. Those are things that kind of keep coming back to me as I look at the photographs. I mean, the project's called Found Memories. The letter U in found is in parentheses, so there's also this kind of other meaning of fond memories. Many of the memories are not always fond, but at the same time, they are, you know, human beings just really trying to find a way to navigate the world in a way that deals with the past, with their present, and in some ways maybe where they're going in the future.
That's writer-in-residence Danny Powell. You can find a link to his work on our website, wmfe.org, and see photos of the Maitland Art and History Centre. Up next, we talk to Brianna Daniel about Ebenezer. It's an old delivery truck that's taken on a new life, delivering toiletries to the homeless. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Brianna Daniel's non-profit Street Team Movement provides laundry services for the homeless in Orlando. But Daniel doesn't want to stop there. Her vision is to provide a place where they can take a hot shower too. In the meantime, she's just acquired an old delivery truck and she's getting ready to take it to the streets.
Right now we are standing outside of Ebenezer, which is our first mobile hygiene truck for the homeless.
Ebenezer?
Ebenezer, yeah. It actually means my rock or stone of hope. So we decided to name him Ebenezer because, one, we wouldn't be able, as a nonprofit that's fairly new, to purchase something like this without God being our rock or our stone of hope. And we're going to use this truck to be the stone of hope to the many homeless that we're going to be serving.
All right, well, let's take a look inside.
So we basically took a Chevy step van, which, if you're not familiar with that, it looks basically like a food truck. And we retrofitted it. We put some shelving inside. We've painted the floor. We've installed a countertop, and we're going to be serving, whereas most food trucks you serve out of a side window, we decided to install a counter and serve out of the back.
And is that so you can just have more shelving down the sides?
Oh, yeah, we're going to have shelving down the middle, so we're having cabinets that are going to be tailor-made to fit those areas. So it's going to be like little cubbies, and here we have where we can hang clothes. So we're going to be hanging like jackets and coats, heavier things that can't really be folded there. And right now it's actually staged, so this is not going to be the final way that it's going to be set. We staged it. We did an unveiling about 2 weeks ago, and we just kind of brought all of our volunteers out and introduced them to the truck and just kind of gave them a general idea of kind of like, this is what it's going to look like full, but this is not how we're going to keep it, because this is not really effective with the number of donations that we actually have in. So,
but this gives you an idea of the kinds of things that people are donating and the sort of things that you need and that you're going to be handing out.
Absolutely, absolutely. Shoes, hats, gloves. These right here are actually prepackaged kits. So I actually opened one this morning, and it's a pair of socks. Mm-hmm. You get gloves in it. Has roll-on deodorant. It has roll-on deodorant. It has toothpaste, toothbrush, and a bar of soap in there. And we have about 400 of those that have been donated from my church.
So the pack is, it's a bunch of toiletries, and it's all rolled up in a
sock.
In a pair of socks.
Yeah.
Okay. And, I mean, the footwear, I'm seeing a bit of a theme here. Is that something that homeless folks are in dire need of?
Oh, yeah. When you live outside, or even if you just live in a shelter and, you know, you get put out of the shelter in the morning, walking is something that is just an everyday part of your life. So you walk a lot. Fresh socks are dire need. Book bags, because you kind of carry your entire life on your back. That's always something that's always asked for. We try not to go out and buy book bags only because they're so costly, but whenever we get donations of book bags, they go so fast. they go very quick.
Is that something that you think people are aware of? I mean, do they think about donating shoes when they're thinking of stuff that they might want to give away to charity?
I'm not sure. We do get a lot of clothes donations, and if we get shoes, we do recommend they are gently worn shoes, because giving, you know, if it doesn't have the sole or doesn't have the support, we don't even bother giving it out, because it's literally going to get tattered within a week. I mean, if you were to put a pedometer on any one of our clients, that thing will be like, the charts will be just astronomical, the number of steps that they take in a day. So even giving out worn shoes, it's not going to last very long. But yeah, new or gently used, well-padded socks and sneakers are pretty much the number one thing that's asked for in work boots.
Any particular sizes that you find you need a lot of?
For women, typically 7, 7.5, 8, 8.5, that range. And then for men, everything over a size 8. Mm-hmm. That's, I mean, you get the whole gambit. So we have 8s. We have a gentleman that he only wears 13 because he can't only wear 13s. And bear in mind that sometimes they have to go a size up because of the being on their feet all day, their feet swell. So we generally have to, like, I wear a size 8.5, but if I was homeless full-time, I would have to probably wear a size 9, 9.5, just for swelling.
Now, I'm wondering if you'd explain how this truck kind of matches what you were describing, because we spoke to you two Thanksgivings ago, and you were outlining your plan, your vision of this mobile kind of ablutions unit. Is this kind of what you envisaged?
Yes and no at the same time. The original truck that we were wanting is a mobile shower truck. And after various ways of trying to get a positive response on that from the community, it just wasn't being met.
And is that because it's an expensive piece of equipment?
Well, one, it's expensive. Two, the community is not really quite ready, if I'd be honest about it. I don't think they understand, like, how to provide mobile services. I think the number one fear of the city was providing or forming forming a new group where people gather. And especially giving a service like this in a downtown area, I know that, you know, it kind of goes against what they want for tourism. So we figured this would be a great gateway to show them, like, hey, we're actually going to be partnering with other nonprofits. We're going to be partnering with other organizations. You're barely even going to notice we're out here, aside of some things that we post on social media. But this is just a really good, we felt was a good step in between to get to the showers and say, hey, we've been providing this for X amount of time. It's been going very well. No altercations. Everything's fine. It's the same exact thing. Just put a shower in it. Mm-hmm. So whereas you see shelves, it would literally be two showers and two sink, toilet, all of that. Just same truck.
Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't need to size up or anything? You could do it with basically the same size as a food truck?
Something the same size as a food truck, absolutely. We'll mm-hmm. just have to retrofit it and do... We can probably do two full-size stalls or maybe three to four half stalls and then do sinks outside or something like that. But, yeah, about this size, you don't even need the CDL to drive it. It doesn't even take diesel. It takes regular gas. I mean, it's very, very easy. And this truck, I believe it cost us $3,500, so it's cheap to get and to maintain.
Does it need a bit of work?
So the truck itself... aside from tune-ups, no, doesn't really need a lot of work. We're going to get a tune-up next week, but we're going to make sure we have... It's an older truck, as you can tell, so, you know, he's a little temperamental, but the previous owner did take very good care of it. He put a new alternator, new motor and everything in it, so it's just maintenance, just routine maintenance, and make sure we stay on top of that, as well as some of the aesthetics that we're going to be doing to the truck itself. So we're going to be painting the shelving. We've already painted the floor. We've got to top coat it. I'm going to be painting our... countertop and adding some whiteboards to the front just aesthetically. Mm-hmm. And we are actually looking for a local artist that would be willing to do a mural around the truck, on the truck. Mm-hmm. One, thinking our sponsors, and just we wanted to go something a little bit different than traditional rap, because it's just, we want to make this a community thing. So getting local artists involved and getting the community involved, that's just really the heartbeat behind not only this project, but we want the community to know that, hey, we're doing something positive. We want you to be a part of it.
Brianna, I've got to ask you about these hats, too. I noticed there's a bit of an FSU theme. What's going on there?
As I said before, this truck is staged. I would have staged it with UCF hats. That's just me. Go Knights. The gentleman that did stage it, these are actually all of only his things. We took one bag of clothes. He happened to have donated shoes, hats, tops, and bottoms in three bags. So I was like, this is the perfect thing to stage this truck. We put it in there. His wife is an interior designer. So it just happened to be staged with a lot of FSU things. Mm-hmm.
And I noticed you've got some what looks like bedding as well.
We do. Yeah. So I work at the Sheraton. It's not really a secret, but I work at... my hotel, they donated over 80 blankets and duvet inserts, which was really cool. So this is all we could fit. I have some in my car still, actually, and then the rest are in our storage unit. And we're going to wait until January. It's January now. Haha. We're going to check the forecast and make sure we pass these out only on the cold nights. And we're actually working out a system to get the blankets back so we can wash them, since we actually do laundry. So we can wash them and then redistribute only as needed, only because, you know, being in Florida, you know, it's cold on Tuesday, but by Wednesday it's back up to 80. So some of our friends do not want to carry a massive comforter around with them. So we're going to work out a way to, which is still in the works, of distributing it as needed and then taking it back, washing it, and just having it ready for when it's going to be another cold night again.
Now, as far as the soap and toiletries and so forth, who's donating those?
Just everybody. Yeah, we actually have a lot of business people that come, and if we're at laundry, they'll drop off 2-3 bags of toiletries at a time. People that just, they travel for a living, and being in Orlando, there's a really big market for that, actually. People that just travel, you know, and sometimes they'll wait 2 or 3 months and bring us, you know, a caboodle, or sometimes they'll just drop off, you know, hey, I got 5 or 6, you know, toiletry items. There you go. You know, keep doing the good thing that you're doing. Mm-hmm. And it literally adds up. I mean, it adds up so fast. We end up having boxes and boxes, or people just come by and drop off, you know, a box of soap, a box of wipes, whatever that looks like. Someone will raid a toiletry stand or at the Walmart or whatever, mm-hmm. the little travel items.
Where do you store all this? Because I'm thinking that aside from the truck, you're going to have a place to keep all the inventory as well, right?
Mm-hmm. We actually have a storage unit, so it's already up, and we rotate everything out. So since we actually have somewhere to keep things that we rotate out, which will be in Ebenezer, We're just making sure that we are keeping close inventory. We're going to make sure we know what's actually going to stay in the truck inventory-wise, and then what's, so we can kind of keep tabs on what's needed always, mm-hmm. and just kind of let the community know about that.
Now, what was Ebenezer in his previous life?
Ebenezer was actually, he was a maintenance truck. So the gentleman that had it before us, he was a repairman. He was pretty much everything, handyman, plumber, electric, carpenter. He actually built our shelf, which is really cool. Because when we called them, it took us, I think we went through 7 trucks until we found one that the owner would kind of come down a little bit on price as well as support what we're using it for. And we told him what we're using it for, and he helped install the shelves, and he built our counter for us. He was really, I mean, and he's 87, which was, yeah, this is astounding.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. It is astounding. So it was really cool. He came on to the vision very quickly. It was his idea to actually put the counter in the back, because I asked him, could he cut a hole in it? And he was like, you know what? We're going to lose a lot of counter shelving space, so it'll be easier to just open the doors in the back. And so we changed the design a little bit. But, I mean, right now it's going to be working. Mm-hmm. Seems to be working really well.
Now, Brianna, Daniel, where are you going to be rolling out the truck? Where are you going to be distributing these toiletry items and other things that you've got in here?
Yeah, so we're going to be doing, it's actually going to be a movable, almost like a compound, if you will. So we're going to have Ebenezer, the truck, is going to be there distributing hygiene items. And we're going to have 3 tents set up. One tent's going to be just for haircuts. So we're going to have 2 barbers on duty as we're going to be passing out hygiene items. And then we're going to rotate a nail technician and a massage therapist once every other week is going to be the theme with them. And then our second tent is going to be healthcare professionals, and they're going to be providing general physicals and health screenings. And then the third one is we've been working on building a job services tent. So we are working with recruiters who are going to be providing, I mean, resume building, resume printing, helping you fill out your application, interview skills, mock interview, all the whole gambit there. And we're going to be passing it out. So we're going to be partnering with an organization that's providing food. So as everyone's done with their food, we're going to be coming out and just doing hygiene.
So it sounds like the plan, the vision has expanded somewhat since the last time we spoke. I mean, you were talking about showers and personal hygiene items, and now it's become haircuts, massage therapy, healthcare services, resumes. You got a lot going on here.
It's a little bit. These are things, I mean, we've been doing haircuts while we provide laundry services. We figured that that was just something that was needed, and we had the space to do it. So we decided to do haircuts along with laundry. And we sporadically did, you know, health screenings, but never like in a formal environment where it was just something that was ongoing. And we just realized that, you know what, we took pretty much most of 2016 to just plan 2017 to say, like, these are the things that we've noticed are needed. How can we provide this, you know, even on a part-time basis? So yeah, it has changed a little bit. The focus is still hygiene for the homeless and just overall wellness, you know, and it's, I guess the vision has changed of what I thought hygiene was, you know. It has shifted a bit, and we've been able to adapt well.
So Brianna, Daniel, January is a tryout month for you, but what happens in February with your mobile unit here and everything else you've got planned?
Yeah, so in February we're actually gonna be rolling Ebenezer out 3 days a week, 1 evening and 2 daytime slots a week. And we're gonna be providing services to, on Mondays it's just gonna be focused on men. And Wednesday's going to be focused just on women. And then when we have our Wednesday evenings, we're just going to be focused on everybody. And it's going to be strictly hygiene and signing people up for laundry services that we provide on Tuesday evenings and Thursday mornings. Mm-hmm. So that is, that's the goal. And we're going to be in strategic places around downtown. We partner with Summit Church for our Wednesdays. So we're going to be providing women care on Wednesdays, which is going to be really cool. And we're really excited to just kind of see like how this is going to go since we've assembled it. How is the homeless community going to react to it? Are there things that we need to tweak before we officially launch in February?
So what have you learned in the last 12 months while you've been getting the truck outfitted and sort of working on all the other aspects of this mobile unit?
So many things I've learned. Partnerships are everything, honestly. I always knew that you can't do this by yourself. It does take a village to raise the My Child street team movement. So, and we, I can say in 2016 that we really did build a village around about support, people that we can call on, people that, you know, can help us from little stuff like building a shelf or painting the floor to oil changes, you know, things that we, you know, we really don't have to fundraise to get, that we can just ask one of our partners and they're like, yeah, we can work on that. Or maybe I can't work on that, but I can find someone that can, you know. And I think 2016 was a really good year to learn about building healthy partnerships and healthy relationships. And I think it helped us as a nonprofit that we're only 3 years old to be able to purchase, you know, our first major thing and to be able to have exposure on it and to have people see like, yeah, we talked about this from day one, but you know, 3 years later, this is what that looks like. And getting everyone involved and letting them know that it's not just us doing this, like everyone is helping us with this.
Mm-hmm. You'd still like to see a mobile shower unit in the future though, right?
Oh, absolutely. That is never... I will definitely be, we'll be bringing that in for sure. So this is going to be our first mobile hygiene truck. And like I said, it's a gateway because on the other side of that gate does lie a mobile shower truck. And we are definitely going to be getting one.
Well, Brianna, Daniel, thank you so much for your time. And thanks for showing us around the mobile hygiene unit.
Absolutely. Thank you, Matthew.
And you can see photos of Ebenezer on our website, wmfe.org. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Talia Blake. The show's executive producer is Catherine Welch. You can find this show and previous episodes on our website or wherever you download your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.